woke up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
Found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining in.
Hello, North Bay Station Jacks. I'm Tom Howe. Greg Pippas on the board doing a save. Our friend Andrew is talking about this, Greg. Can you jinx yourself, do you think? Last week I was telling him that my nephew and his whole gang, one of the young ones, came home from school with some germ, and they all got a cold for a few days, and he said, "Oh, I've been really lucky. I haven't had like a cold for like 7 years."
Yeah, he shouldn't have done that.
So this morning he calls. He goes, "I caught this thing at work yesterday, and it was really bad. Then I went home, and last night I felt better. Figured, okay, I can tough it out. I come in and do the show. I wake up this morning, and it's long because I don't. I'm like, I don't want to ride in with you either if you're like that. So, thanks for coming in and doing the save. We'll do a little something here.
It happens.
S&P futures down 3. NASDAQ futures up 21. They were both up earlier. Now we're leaking a little bit into the Fed meeting. We've been up 2 days in a row. Everybody's expecting him to not say a whole hell of a lot. Definitely no rate cut. They're thinking the rate cut might become June now. But for a while, what was it, Greg? It was a 90% chance the futures predicted a rate cut in March, and now it's down to what, 2% or something?
So you're saying people can't predict the future?
I don't think they... I think everybody's really underestimating this inflation stuff.
Oh.
They've been underestimated the whole
time. I think everybody's full of crap.
Well, there you go. So guess who has the story this morning? Greg, tell us how your voting went.
I don't know. Should I say it on the air?
Why not? If it's the truth.
It's the truth.
Is it said on the CTA bus every morning, the sign, "When the truth hurts, it should"?
Yeah, so I went, voted. Flip the sheet over to the what's it called, proposal, the transfer tax proposal.
Yeah, transfer tax increase.
And it was already marked yes. So I went and gave my ballot back. I said, "I think there's a mistake." And she said, "Oh, maybe this might have been a this might have been a spoiled ballot."
Yeah.
So they're just counting on people not to turn it over.
I guess. I mean, I'd like to think it was an accident, but something, so the cynical side says, you know, that's not really.
Actually, it looks like it lost.
It looks like it lost, but they still got 100,000 to count, so.
There's that many from the.
The mail-ins.
Well, they count them when they come in, and it had to be postmarked by yesterday, right?
Nobody would ever monkey with the mail-ins.
Right.
No, so. God, no. Well, you know, there was a time, I believe, I had a friend. It was a long time ago, a lady friend who was been a judge forever. Remember the year that, God, what's the guy's name? Nobody likes the guy. But he was the county, was he the county treasurer for about Claypool? Is that his name, Forrest Claypool?
Yeah, he was the Park District and then the CTA.
Yeah, and he ran for county commissioner against Stroger's kid. And anyway, my friend was telling me that it used to be that for you to get, you know, an absentee ballot, you pretty much had to give them a reason. You know, you're on vacation, you're in the Army. Most of the people were in the Army and or doing something overseas, for usually for government. And those ballots had to make it by election day to the precinct. I think this is right. And they were essentially counted in the precinct the same way the regular ballots were. A person's signature was was checked against the signature and all that stuff. Well, the first time he had to, you know, when Claypool ran against Stroger, they said, "Oh no, we're going to take all the absentee ballots," which they used to call them, "and we're going to bring them down to the county building." And that's when Claypool says, "Screw that!" And he kind of marched down to the county building. I mean, they didn't break in or anything, but everybody said, "Ah, he's a poor loser. He's just said he was like, he knew what was going on in there, probably." But now, I guess as long as it's postmarked by yesterday, you count it whenever it shows up, right? Right, gang? I think that's the deal. I was reading that this morning. But Kevin, this could be a new first for me. I actually voted for two things that might have won. I voted against this that transfer team, and I voted for the new lady in the Democratic Party doesn't like for. State's attorney, Burke.
Oh, good job. Hey, tell me this, the transfer tax, what is that, on sale of property?
Sale of property, and I forget what it actually is now. It's now $375 for every 500 hours of transfer. And what they're going to do is go to a graduated tax where it went down under $1 million, and then for the part over $1 million, it went to $5, then it went, well, I think it went to 10 for over $1.5 million. So it became a very graduated tax, but I don't like that necessarily, Kevin.
And what was the justification? What's the justification for having that tax at all?
It totally justified. The money was going to go only to the homeless.
No. That's the use. But what's the justification for that particular tax?
It's sort of always been there. You know, at the current level. The logic of if you want to lower the price of living in Chicago, you don't raise the tax on property. I mean, duh.
Well, it seems like what they're doing is with all of the people, the more mobile people, the people who have money that can afford to leave. It sounds like they're saying we're gonna tax you to leave. Essentially, yeah. You want to sell your property and get out of here. We're gonna tax the crap out of you on the way out the door.
Well, exactly.
That's an exit tax. That's an exit tax. They talk about that in California too, and it's just a way of saying, well, if you're gonna leave, we're gonna put our hands in your pockets one last time.
Well, but both sides pay the tax, right? Really.
I understand that, but they're trying to make it uneconomical to sell your property.
But then the question is, somebody, you can't sell it to the heir, you got to sell it to somebody. Now that buddy has to pay coming in and going out, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, they had two people on at issue on Sunday morning, a lady, and she's for it, and some guys. Given kind of the economic argument about it's a tax on property. When you have a tax on property, rents go up, not down. And she was, you know, absolutely aghast that he would say something like that. And it's all for the homeless. And then I had a long conversation with Mr. Flanagan on Monday because he knows more about this than me. I thought that in order for it to be totally dedicated to one thing, it had to be a specific tax line. And Johnson, like for instance, when you get your
we have a the lake where I live, we have a special taxing district for weed treatment on the lake because we need to get rid of it, certain invasive species of weeds so that the lake is usable, and at the same time it has to be treated properly so you can't just dump weed killer in there, you wind up with a dead lake and no fish and all of that. So we all agreed. I mean, we had a vote on this and all agreed, but it's a line item, and that tax has to be collected and it goes into an account for that the township gets, and then after it's collected, then they have to, the payments for the weed abatement go every year, go directly out of that account. And well, I know that's not what John said is not the case here, but that's the way it's supposed to work.
Well, I mean, I guess in my mind, again, which is probably, I'm probably wrong on this, because actually, Kevin, as much as people think I'm this big conspiracy guy, I actually cut these guys a break once in a while. I always felt that there was a difference between, let's say, the soft BS and the real BS. I mean, when I say the soft and the real thing, not the real BS.
Yeah, up to your ankles or up to your knees.
Well, I mean, when somebody says something like the lottery is going to go for schools.
And it does.
Well,
and it does.
Well, but again,
other money comes out of the schools instead.
Well, I'm saying I don't think they are necessarily obligated to take every lottery money and put it in there, unless, in other words, I thought like the mosquito abatement district was their own account someplace because it's a line item on the tax return, and that it had to go there, like the Metropolitan Sanitary. I mean, it had to go there. John says they can take that too if they want to. But I never dreamed of something like this. You know, this particular thing is going to go for the home. I don't know that every single transfer tax piece is going to go into some separate account that if they don't use it for the homeless, it's going to stay there forever. I don't buy that for a second.
Well, I don't buy it either, but, you know, they have these newfangled computer system thingies that will actually account for all of that. So it isn't hard to do it correctly.
Well, correctly, if you need the money somewhere else, I don't know, Greg, have you noticed?
Need the money somewhere else? Oh. That's okay. Be transparent. Go out and ask for at least a public referendum, if not a change to the law. But if they write the laws properly, then they will, and they say this is going to go for the homeless, and that's the way the law is written, then you create an account, and it's certain homeless activities, and the law is supposed to say exactly what kinds of things that they can do. And I know that's not the case here, but that's the way it's supposed to work.
Well, there was. I'm driving home. We're talking about changing the subject. I'm driving home, and I went down a street I don't normally do. Greg, what is with these? And these are on residential streets now, Kevin. Where at the corners they narrow the street down and have this big concrete thing, some kind of a platform of some kind. But behind it, in order for the water to run to the sewer, there's a big hole in it. So you could easily step into the gutter there and like break an ankle or something, and then there's this massive speed bump right at the corner. It's done in I'm sure it's not cobblestone, but it's the concrete that's made to look like cobblestone. It's the red concrete, mm-hmm. and they press on it and makes it look like it's cobblestone, but it's not. They got these on every corner. I'm thinking, who dreamed this up, and what does a corner cost, and what is the purpose of that? Especially
the purpose of it is to make through traffic more of a pain in the butt, and to make criminal escapes more of a pain in the butt.
Well, I mean, we also have a city that
about that in the past.
But also is a city that gets an awful lot of snow. How the hell do you plow that?
We didn't think it through, Tom.
Anyway, so we've got the Fed coming out today with their stuff. I actually enjoyed a couple of those NIT games last night, Kevin. They were pretty close.
I didn't watch them. I was watching the first four game with Howard, and then I watched a little of Virginia, which was just god-awful. And then I fell asleep. Then I went to sleep.
Well, I watched the Howard game, too. Those guys, how many three-pointers did they get near the end? They blew all of them.
They got three in a row, and they didn't make any of them, but it was like, take one, miss it, get the rebound, kick it back out. They did everything right except make the shot.
Yeah, it was. Now those guys, they have to play the number one seed, so they're kind of toast. But the 10 guys get to play a 7, so they have a game under their belt. I don't know if you want to be the 7 playing somebody who already won a game. You don't got a choice, but I think the tens are probably almost. I'd say it's almost an even game, wouldn't you?
Sure, yeah. What's the big upset line? 5s and 12s? But yeah, that doesn't mean that 10s and 7s don't have upsets. So, I've got to pick up my bracket for the Warren Buffett contest.
Well, I was giving Greg a ride. You were in the car, Greg, when I got done. I was listening to they had some prognosticator on there, and he was all over. Somebody was a 12. I don't know if it was Canyon State or somebody, but he didn't like the 5. So he had him beating the 5, and then he had him beating the next team.
Grand Canyon. That's actually a private university, and I think it's the only for-profit university in Division I.
Really? They're in Phoenix, right?
They're in Arizona. I'm not sure that they're in Phoenix or if they're a little bit north of Phoenix. But, yeah, I think they are. They may be in Phoenix.
Well, I believe
I think Bryce Drew is their coach.
Well, he had them winning. Then he had him send the guys that, if they win, the next team they got to play, they kind of suck too. He had him going like 16 or maybe 8. that was his big bracket. I don't know. Are you going to pick a team to beat a number one or two? I wouldn't know those teams from Adam, so I don't know who to pick.
Well, I think North Carolina will be vulnerable.
Well, Purdue's vulnerable because they sure were 2 years ago.
Well, Purdue's always vulnerable. They always have trouble advancing. I think that Purdue, at least this time, seems to have a better contingent of shooters to put around Lurch. So
I picked Houston. We'll see Houston, how that works Wisconsin.
Out. You had Greg's got his beater is Wisconsin beating Houston.
It could happen. You know, Wisconsin's got some real talent on that team. They hit a rough patch, but they're playing good basketball now.
Where do you put? I was discussing this with my buddy Bill Murphy last night. Where do you put DePaul? They're a number three, but they're getting one of their best players back from injury, I think. So, is the three already anticipate that, or?
I'm sorry, DePaul?
Yeah, not DePaul. I'm sorry, Marquette. DePaul, too. They're old,
Marquette.
For you.
Okay, Marquette.
No, for Marquette.
Yeah, if they're getting Kolek back, they're a dangerous team.
One guy has one guy. I sound like the idiots on TV.
Kolek was Big East Player of the Year last year.
Really? Well, yeah. Some of the dudes on TV are claiming they can pick 15 teams that could potentially win. That should be a fun tournament.
Yeah, I don't know about win, but certainly get to the Final Four in there. Certainly there's. I think there's probably right. The 12 to 15 teams that could get to the Final Four, and then you see. Then you see what happens.
Hey, the rumor last night, as I was up at the local place after elections, the 20 teams said no to the NIT. Is that true?
A bunch did, yeah. And Russell said yesterday none of his teams are playing. Two of them, Memphis and Indiana, said no, thank you.
Why? Why would you do that? Just out of curiosity.
Well, Tom Crean actually had a rant on television about that, and he said, there's plenty of time to do anything else you want to do. That now's the time when you have an opportunity to play basketball. Why wouldn't you want to compete? But teams are opting out of it, in large numbers. St. John's did. St. John's should have been in the NCAA tournament, and then they said no, thank you to the NIT. And
if there were,
and they don't have to travel. If they get to Madison Square Garden, they don't have to go anywhere.
If there are a couple teams that I use the term weaseled in by winning their conference thing, if there were two or three teams that most people feel should have been in that were on the outside looking in because of that, who would they be? I mean, who are the teams you think that were closest to the?
I think St. John's would be one of them. I'd have to look at who those bubble teams that were left out were, but St. John's would be one. And the perfect example of how I think it should work is Virginia, because Virginia is you saw in a text thread, they lost to the Irish before the Irish started to play good ball, and it wasn't even a close game. That alone should have been like disqualification from any further consideration. But in their case, Virginia just was not very good. They won a lot of games, but they never looked good doing it, and they had some real blowout losses. Now, if the ACC is going to crown its champion based on the tournament rather than the regular season, that's the conference's prerogative. But then if you have a team like North Carolina State, who was not going to be in the NCAA tournament, and they go out and they win five games in a row and take the championship, that shouldn't knock out a Big East team. That should knock out an ACC team. And so, Virginia should have been the team that got knocked out, not somebody from the Big East or not somebody from, the Mountain West or something like that.
Well, my buddy Bill, who's really, really does the Big East because he's a big Marquette guy, he calls that conference only getting three teams was an abomination.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true. And, so I don't know, why they wouldn't do it that way, but they didn't, and so the ACC got rewarded. And the crazy thing about it is that that's actually a perverse incentive if you're not going to knock out a Big East team.
Right.
And by that I mean they got to the championship game against North Carolina. Now, I'm not saying North Carolina lost on purpose. I'm not even suggesting that that was a consideration. However, it was in North Carolina's financial interest to lose that game, because
right.
one more ACC team into the tournament meant that that everybody in the ACC is going to get more money, because they you know, that it's the conferences that get paid, and then they split it up among their members. So they actually had a they were going to be in anyway. Getting one more team in as a financial incentive for North Carolina to lose in the championship game. You should never want that kind of a situation. It should, you know, that you just don't want to create that, even though it may not be a deciding factor, a significant factor. You don't think anybody's going to lose on purpose. Nevertheless, why would you build perverse incentives like that? It just doesn't make
well,
sense.
Well, whenever the intelligent people on this show talk, they always give me like two or three further questions, so it's never a problem for me to... The play-in game, that's considered a regular spot in terms of money going forward?
Yeah, I believe it's just, you know, I think it just gets the
so there's actually,
the one payment. Yeah, because it has to be, because otherwise, you know, Howard getting eliminated, then you know, what, are they going to get a half share for that? And their conference is, because they're not a two-bid conference, so you don't want to create, you know, that situation.
Well, so there's actually... 64, there's actually 1, 2, 3, there's actually 68 shares.
Yeah.
The first round.
Sure.
All right. Okay, second question is, not that they things should ever match up and everybody should decide everything by money, although it seems like people do. How is it that schools will trip over their tongue to get into some stupid bowl game when half their guys don't want to play and they get 2 weeks of practice or 3 weeks and they have to beat up on the alumni to buy tickets for a game that nobody wants to go to. Everybody falls over their male appendage to do that. And yet the NIT...
Well, I don't know that they do, Tom. I don't know that that's the case. However, what is the situation is this, where you have people opting out of the NIT, which would also, by the way, would also pay money to the conference. But... when you have people, while you have that situation, the agreements that the conferences make with bowls to line them up and to lock in their spots require everybody to accept when offered.
Well,
you don't get an option to turn it down.
But what they're interviewing one of the coaches, and it was he was absolutely giddy. Did he get to practice 3 more weeks with the next team, and he didn't care if the seniors were out because it was like a spring game, and he got a head start on everybody else. And yet you have the risk of injury and all that kind of stuff, which you do walking off the curb, I know. But basketball, I don't see anywhere near the expense. I don't see you having to lean on your alumni. Why would you ever say no? Plus, I mean, I would. I mean, the thought of me at age 40 playing tackle football. But I could have played basketball at 40 without any really. I guess I could have hurt myself, but you know, why would you ever turn down 3 basketball games when it's a whole different program? All you do is make some dough and enjoy yourself.
Yeah, all I can say is from the coach's perspective, as I think about it, and I'm just thinking about it as you asked the question, the football coaches do love having the extra practice time, and that's as much as anything. That's because a lot of freshmen don't play or don't play but a couple of games, and they have a year of eligibility left. But, you know, the physical demands and the physical development required to get on the field is substantial. And so when they look at it as extra practice time and an extra spring game and all of that kind of stuff, it's really true. If you turn around and you look at the roster on a basketball team, pretty much everybody who's going to be a good player for that program is playing no matter what. I mean, because it's a limited roster size, and so they play in the rotation. You might have somebody on your team who is you know, who doesn't play or who sat out to preserve a year of eligibility. If you, you know, if you got somebody who's not an NBA caliber player but is going to be a good player. But you also, the eligibility rules in football, as long as you don't play more than four games, they don't care which four games, you preserve a year of eligibility. In basketball, if you play after a certain date, like, you know, after a third of the season, first of all, if you play at all, you use your eligibility, and unless you get injured early in the season, in which case they will waive that year of eligibility and let you come back. So the eligibility rules are different for the sport.
Okay.
In fact, the eligibility rules are different for all kinds of sports. So there's no developmental angle where you say, oh, good, I finally get to get my redshirt guy on the court. That'll burn a year of eligibility, and they don't want to do that.
I'm just saying, if I'm a starting tackle not going to the pros, and got basically my head beat in all year, I thought of three more weeks of practice and going to the toilet bowl, God knows where, in front of five fans versus playing in Madison Square Garden basketball if I'm St. John's. I don't even think it's close for me anyway.
Yeah, I would bet if you ask the football teams, if you ask the football teams if they want to play, they'd probably say no. Not 100% no, but they would probably have a majority of the players would say no. And, of course, the seniors opt out, but the juniors can't, or, you know, the underclassmen can't, because then you piss off the coach and you never get to play. So the guys who are leaving all opt out, and so when you see that, how many guys that have a chance at an NFL career decide to play just because of love of the game? None, or yeah, virtually none. So that gives you some insight into what the players are thinking. Whereas in basketball, you might actually get guys who play because, you know, the basketball circuit, you know, as these guys came up in high school and they played all summer, nothing but tournament, you know, AAU tournament after AAU tournament, you might get the players more interested than the coaches in this.
I'm either going to go play at Madison Square Garden next week, or I'm going to go have a pickup game at The Rock, which I'd rather do.
Yeah, which would you rather do? And these guys just spent a lot of years playing tournament after tournament after tournament, and you know that from being a softball player. Playing tournaments is fun.
Oh yeah.
I think there's a whole different mindset. Yeah, you can't treat the you can't consider the thinking to be the same for each sport.
Well, the teams last night, I thought were pretty good.
I really think the opt out is more the coaches in the basketball case.
Well, I would say, just in the games I watched last night, this is not a big plug for the NIT. The top 15 teams in the NIT I would take them against any of the bottom 25 teams in the NCAA.
Well, yeah, but you know, then you got to start sifting out the automatic qualifiers.
I'm not saying you should do that. I'm just saying. The game I watched last night, I forget who it was way better than the Howard other thing, except for the last minute.
I mean, it was Virginia-Colorado State.
Yeah, it was Virginia-Colorado State. I mean, who was the other one? There was another one.
Wagner-Howard.
That wasn't a bad game either. That was a good game, actually.
Yeah, that was real close.
Well, it wasn't close until about 2.5 minutes, and all of a sudden Howard had an improbable rally to get back in it and was shooting for the tie at the end. And it closed it to a point, fouled a guy who made two free throws, and then they were shooting three-pointers for the tie. It was a dramatic finish. Most of the game wasn't very good, though. Howard did have their starting post player. Dom Campbell is one of the three guys who transferred out of Notre Dame when Mike Bray decided to leave.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, so Dom Campbell was there. Vanderbilt had a very talented forward who left Notre Dame named Van Allen Lubin. And I don't know what's going to happen with him now, because I think Jerry Stackhouse is going to get canned from Vanderbilt, the head coach. And then the third, J.J. Starling, plays for Syracuse.
Well, shifting gears totally, because we'll talk about more with the NCAA on Friday. Friend Mike is going to want to pile in on that a little bit. What did you, in terms of Russell and I finally had our pretty high level Vicks conversation yesterday. How understandable do you think that was for the regular listener?
Uh, I think today, because Russell had mentioned that he could follow up today, I think there was some room for follow up on there that would make it more understandable. So it was interesting, and you know, I consider me the regular listener. I'm sort of following along and getting it, but I, you know, a little more drill in and Q&A probably would have been good.
Well, I did a big expert witness thing a while ago, a few years ago actually, and the they had a somebody from, and it's a really difficult topic. I mean, it's there's people in the industry that can't really explain where it all came from and what it all means. So maybe so in the testimony, you know, in the room, the risk manager for some big firm, and I won't mention the name, she comes in and was talking about how this person had lost all this money, and how they, in my opinion, the firm was, and again, for me to say the firm was at fault, is, you know, since I own a firm, is pretty tough for me to do. But in this case, I think they were at fault, and of course they won because they were a big firm. But long story there, but these guys had some massive position in a retail account. It was a really big account, but it was still a retail account. And the other firm allowed these guys to trade essentially unencumbered during the day as if they were a market maker, which they weren't. And when I say that, Kevin, when I was on the trading floor, I could trade all day long, you know, 350 trades. Sometimes I traded by hand. And there were probably many times in there, if I bought 100 lot or sold 100 lot of something, actually, I was never that crazy, and I had a pretty decent size account in those days, so I never really probably stretched the envelope at all of risk, really. I mean, during the crash, I got clobbered because I had 1 month that expired and I couldn't get to the next month because the whole system shut down. But that was an outlier. Most of the time, I was pretty much covered. But there are people that weren't. You know, they'd have 50 grand in their account, and at one point they'd be short like 500 options or something. Where if you ever just stopped the proceedings right there, you'd say you don't have enough to cover that. But as a market maker, professional trader, the only time you looked at the position was what somebody came in at the end of the day. Anyway, so they let these guys trade this big, and they end up getting caught. Anyway, long story, but they lost a lot of money. So the lady comes in, and she was talking about the market being volatile. And the attorney says, "What do you mean by volatile?" She says, "Well, you know, volatile." And he goes, "I don't know." That's why I'm asking. You're the risk manager. Was it more volatile than the day before? Less? Is it more volatile than the month before? What does that even mean? He goes, "Define volatility for me." And she goes, "You know, volatility." And he goes, "I don't know." And by the way, you can't say define red and say red.
You can't define a word with itself.
With itself. And so anyway, it kind of got into this long pissing match, basically. And when you look at what it really is, and I'll try and go back to the very basics even here for a few minutes, and when you say volatility, there's actually like four definitions. There's historical volatility, okay, how volatile a stock has been vis-a-vis standard deviation for the last year, 2 years, 10 years, whatever you want to do. And even that's kind of an iffy sort of thing, because you always take, Greg, back me up on this, you always take close to close, which has been the convention since day one, since 1973 when the options opened. But, or actually since Fisher Black and those guys put the model together. But, so in theory, a stock could close at 50, the next day trade 60 and trade 40 and close again at 50, and the volatility is zero when it really isn't, okay? But at least normally you say we know the historical volatility as it's defined, which you do.
So you could do it hour by hour, but if you draw the trend line through it, it's still going to be 50.
Right, right. But they actually just take close to close. That when you go back and say,
I get it. But if someone wants to say, well, it's volatile within a day, within a trading day, you can chart that too.
Right. Oh yeah. Well, you'd have to take it hour by hour. You have to do something,
I agree. Okay, so it's the same thing. I do the same kind, use the same kind of statistics for run control in manufacturing.
And then there's future volatility, which we all would like to know, that nobody knows how volatile it's going to be in the future in terms of close to close. Same definition. But the one that you're also kind of looking for is the implied volatility, which you should know. So, for instance, let's take IBM. And if you look at an option, well, IBM, we know the stock is trading 193.41. So that's a given. We should know the interest rate. That's a given. Okay. Even though there's a difference between, there's actually two interest rates. There's the interest rate at which if you buy the stock, how much you have to pay. And if you sell the stock, how much you're going to get as a rebate as a short stock. But it won't be that. You know the time.
Don't go down that road.
Don't go down that road. Okay. We know the timed expiration. Okay. And we know the strike price. So the only variable now we're left with is what's the last variable? And if I can tell you the option's trading for $5, if I back it through the model, I can say, whoa, IBM's trading at a 25. So in other words, if I went the other way and put a 25 volatility into the model, that's the price the option would spit out. So you're just backing up. So there's at least three different kinds of volatilities. You know, there's the historical, there's the implied, and there's the future. One, two you know, and one you don't. So when people say volatility, you got to say, which one are you talking about, right? And so what the VIX does is it takes the spot VIX, says, okay, these SPX calls this month, are trading at these prices. We're going to average that implied volatility. So the spot VIX is going to be, where it is this morning, I've got it at, where do I have it? 14.07. So that's the spot VIX. However, the VIX is actually a future. Not, they have spot options, but there's also VIX futures. So if you look out a month and a half or two, and Greg can get these numbers exact, I'm going to say that the future in July is trading at 15.5, 15.75. So people are anticipating that the volatility in July is going to be higher than it is now through the future. So if you look at the individual options, you're going to say, wow, the spot is 14.07. Why are the $8 calls, which should be like 6.07 because they're deep in the money, why are they 7.50? Well, that's why. And then if you look at the 25 puts, you'd say, well, that should be $11 because it's the difference between 25 and 14 at least. And you're going to see that trade in 9.5, and you go, So the first thing you have to do is adjust the price of the VIX. And when you look at your option screen, you got to shove the price up $1.50 to see what you're dealing with, because you're looking at an implied price. So to trade the VIX, I would say that you probably need somebody, a broker, of course, who nobody thinks they need. Or a lot of some people do. As a matter of fact, more people are thinking they do again. You need somebody who knows what the hell they're talking about. You need a me. You need a Greg. You need somebody who Greg is not a broker, but you need somebody who understands this stuff. I mean, Russell's the genius now. He wrote a book on it. You know, the best one there is. So, I mean, you know, be careful when you get down these roads. Go ahead.
And what I suggest is do some follow-up with Russell next week on it, because he does this. Not only has he written the book on it, but he teaches this for a living.
Yep.
So he knows, he's good at getting in front of a group of people, or in our case, a group of listeners, and just sort of laying it out, break it out step by step. And he started down that road yesterday, and, you know, let him roll with it, because, you know, I think it'll be a good service to people.
Right. And the only thing that I have to keep bringing him back to a little bit, and maybe it's because of I'm a little older, is that we traded the volatility long before there was a VIX. You just knew that was the implied volatilities.
Yep.
And when you look at a stack, for instance, like MicroStrategy, and I'll kick the thing up right now. But now this thing is all over the place because it's involved in the Bitcoin, and the Bitcoin's going all over the place. So duh. Now this thing, the implied volatility in here, actually, it won't come up until before the close. What do you expect it is, Greg? It's got to be over 200, isn't it?
For the MicroStrategy?
Yeah, it's easily got to be over 200.
I mean, it's a if the stock is trading, if they are Bitcoin-based valuation or whatever, and they have $1 billion in Bitcoin, but they're trading $2 billion market cap. You know, that's how do you price that?
It's Wednesday morning, and the
is there that much added value?
Well, Wednesday morning, which it is today, the Friday night straddle, the 1450 straddle, which is where it is, the Friday night straddle is $185. So that's like what 14% move in 3 days. It's got to be a 250 volatility. It's got to be because we're talking about something that it could really be anywhere. And I don't know how anybody trades it, but people are. I mean, it's an okay trader, but I don't know how many. I don't have a lot of clients that can be winging $79 options around, Craig. Somebody call up and say, buy me a 50 lot of those things, I'd say, wait a minute, you got the right stock?
Well, isn't that why you give people margin?
There's no margin on options. Yeah.
Maybe there's a market for that. Oh, yeah. I've got implied volatility of 205%.
Right, there's one more thing I want to slip in here, and we can talk about it more on Friday. And that is I sent you a chart and there's a whole study, and I can share that with you as well. But Larry Summers and a couple of other professors published a paper recently where they went back and they took pricing and they used the pricing model before 1983 of how we used to calculate inflation. And they calculated last year a little over 18%, and this year I think we're running something like 8.
He's absolutely correct.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And see, this is this understanding, and you know, there's all kinds of little nuggets in the paper. You know, for instance, it used to be a little better than half of the basket was food and clothing. Now it's less than 20%.
The housing too. How they calculate the housing.
When you have the politicians and the pundits all saying, well, inflation's down, and the average people aren't buying it, this is why they aren't buying it, because the stuff that really, you know, because the reality, the true reality of what the people experience is the 18%, not, you know, not 12, not 6, not 3, not whatever. And it's really just kind of it's an interesting way to look at it. I'm not suggesting that it should be calculated exactly the way it used to be because we have new factors, but I do suspect that a lot of the changeovers that were made were after, you know, as inflation started to subside after being, you know, completely out of control in the late 70s and early 80s. And so I do suspect a lot of those changes were made for political reasons so that we never saw those kinds of rates again, instead of for practical reasons like, oh, the world changed in 1983.
Well, Kevin, let's kick that around more on Friday, because one of the changes, the structural changes that they did make, and I don't know how you make this into a formula, is they did something regarding substitution, that if the cost of beef triples, and it's 3% of the basket to start with, it's not really going to triple because probably people are going to substitute more pork and chicken, which means the 3% might actually be nudging down towards 2.5. There's a certain.
Yeah, so the question is, what's your grocery bill when you go to the checkout counter and you're buying a week's groceries for your family of four? What's it cost you?
Well, the most egregious,
and then you start asking other questions, other add-on questions like, well, what did you decide not to buy because you can't, you know, we can't buy ice cream anymore. It's just too damn expensive. We got to cut something out, so we're not buying ice cream. And we're not going to have dessert this week. You know, that's the kind of, you know, there's a whole conversation that goes around that. We sort of get to it a lot on the show. But it really is, you know, what's the real rate of inflation? And people like to argue and say, look, it's right there. There's the number. And, you know, I think that there is a qualitative part of the argument as well as a quantitative part of the argument.
Well, if you were to take, and we got a dash here because we have plenty of time on Friday, three outliers that I actually looked at a while ago, and I've said this on the air. One is medical care. The idea that it's 6.5% of your basket when it's 21% of the economy is stone cold idiocy.
That might have been true. That might have been true in the early 80s.
Right. It might have been true.
So that's why I meant, that's what I meant when I said a lot of things, there are things that have changed, and then, but we didn't change that one.
Well, for, I mean, last gasp here, if this thing, this transfer tax would have passed in Chicago, that's not in there. And some of it's...
Agree. It isn't in there, but it'll show up in rent.
But now your tolls, if you were to take, if you double the tolls for the stiffs that come through that don't have the easy pass, but you only raise the other guys up 5%, now is did you double it or did you raise it 5%? And by the way, is it even counted in the first place? I don't know if tolls even are. I bet they aren't. So is it a stupido tax on the people stupid enough not to have the easy pass or can't get one? And say, well, that doesn't count. I mean, there's a million questions in here, and every one of them, the other one is higher education is not in there. Taxes are not in there. I mean, it's crazy. Anyway, Kevin, thank you very much for coming on later. Greg, thank you very much for coming in for Andrew. We got some stuff done, and on Friday we'll kick up the rest, and we'll be back tomorrow with our regular Hal and the, or not Hal, we got Lou and the rest of the gang tomorrow. So
we got Lou in the morning.
Yeah, we got Lou in the morning. Be right back tomorrow morning, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.